Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Finding your perfect home was hard, but thanks to Burrow, furnishing it has never been easier. Burrow's easy-to-assemble modular sofas and sectionals are made from premium, durable materials, including stain and scratch-resistant fabrics. So they're not just comfortable and stylish, they're built to last. Plus, every single Burrow order ships free right to your door. Right now, get 15% off your first order at burrow.com/ACAST. That's 15% off at burrow.com/ACAST.
Hi, I'm Helen.
And I'm Stephen.
And this is the New Statesman podcast. We promised people last week that we'd give them a break from Europe, but...
We lied.
I'm getting into Europe. No, I am. I did slightly get into Europe.
But it's like the thing, isn't it? Like, one by one, the EU referendum is going to kill all of us and take over our bodies.
It was truly mad yesterday. People were talking about Boadicea. But there was quite a long, sustained argument about whether the suffragettes would have been in or out
so
of the EU.
You spent International Women's Day with...
International Women.
International Women. You started with...
It was Women for Britain, it was called. So that was the Out campaign's launch, and that was in One Great George Street, which is just around the corner from Westminster and the House of Commons, in a big wood-panelled room. And so that was hosted by Suzanne Evans of UKIP. And I'd like to take a small detour here to say that whatever crazy power struggle is going on in UKIP is a really bad thing for anybody who wants UKIP to be better than it is, because the people who are being sidelined, Patrick Flynn and Suzanne Evans, are both really good media performers. Now, I don't, you know, it's not in my interest to see UKIP succeed, but if you look at it from a pragmatic point of view, they're both really good speakers. And Suzanne Evans is really not, does not sound mad at all.
Yeah, if you were... I mean, if, say, instead of people running parties because they shared an interest in them, and if they were just, like, randomly assigned, like, a draft pick in American football, those are not players you would be...
No, you would not be benching them.
You know, they're there.
You wouldn't be going, let's send out Nigel Farage for the 400 millionth appearance to look slightly ranty. So she introduced it, and then we also had a couple of other MPs, the biggest of whom was Priti Patel, Cabinet Minister, who has now come out for out, as it were, alongside a couple of... The phrase that keeps being used is small business women, but that just makes them sound like they're like micro pigs. I mean,
she is also a small business
woman. She is a very... she is a delicate type of person. But it was quite interesting. So there are a couple of things I found about it. So Priti's speech had... So she referenced all this. She said, you know, British women have never been afraid of speaking up, from Boadicea to Elizabeth I to Elizabeth Garrett Anderson to Florence Nightingale. And I just, that was, I really struggled to kind of get back on the horse of listening to what everyone was talking about at that point, because I was just sort of there going, would Boadicea have cared about the common agricultural policy?
I mean, Boadicea did go to war against a project to unify the European continent. See, that actually works.
That's true. Okay, yeah, let's make John Elledge write a piece about what Boadicea have been an outer, because he would be the one to do it justice. Amaray Trevelyan, MP for Berwick-on-Tweed. And then they had a video of the 16-year-old who appeared on Question Time. Do you remember her, Lexi Hill?
No, I don't watch Question Time anymore.
That's fair. She was doing basically a junior William Hague, where it's sort of slightly adorable that a teenager is talking about unconstitutional withdrawal of sovereignty, but also a bit alarming, and you kind of want to go, have some cider, go to the park, live a little, you're 16.
But it would be great if she became a successful politician, and then she went through a like period where she needed to be, you know, like when they kept relaunching Ed Miliband and hoping that would fix the problem, and then obviously it didn't, you know, where they rebooted her, and you could have the headline, they're bringing Lexi back.
Oh, no.
All the build-up for that
punchline. I can't believe you spent that on building up that joke. And then the final person was Emma... Well, so there was Pauline First, who runs an accountancy firm, and Emma Pullen, who is a former air hostess, that's how they introduced her, who took over her father's business, which turns out to be called the British Hovercraft Company. Now, did you know that her hovercrafts, which cost £50,000, if she wants to export them to Brazil, she has to pay 80% export tax on them, meaning I believe that they then cost 90%. no, 84, 94. They cost a lot more. The hovercrafts cost a lot more if you try and send them to Brazil,
Is there a booming market for hovercrafts?
Apparently there is, because this is what I didn't realise, is that you use them if you're really rich to get to your yacht. They're like your launch. Obviously, you can't bring your yacht that close to shore, so you have a hovercraft to get you to your yacht.
I mean, these people probably can afford to pay the extra excess. But also, I'm sorry, what? There are people who are so rich and they have a hovercraft.
A boat to get them to their boat.
To get them to their boat. And it's the EU we're angry about? I mean...
Yeah, that was one of those moments where, and then someone else told me quite a lot about one of the reasons, you know, women would be angry about the fact, because women care a lot about environmentalism, about the fact that there is a 20% VAT on solar panels, and actually it could be much lower. But this is also the thing, I mean, Kate Hoey's mentioned this to me before, is that, you know, that we all got very upset about the tampon tax, and actually it can't go below 5%, this VAT on sanitary products, because that is the EU minimum. You know, that is one, I know it's wonktacular, but you can't really, you know, weird VAT things are, you know, a lot of the things that we get upset about are down to Brussels. So that was the morning. I then took some hours in a darkened room to recover, and then at 6:30 I headed over to the hospital club in London's trendy Soho district for the Women for In launch. And that one, we got a no-show from Miriam Gonzalez-Gerantes, which was quite sad because I had a lot of chat about her food blog that I was willing to go into, Mum and Sons, that I was quite up for raising with her. But that was hosted by June Sarpong, who is the kind of youth ambassador for the pro-EU case. Stella Creasy, Labour MP, Nicky Morgan, Tory cabinet minister, and Natalie Bennett. Natalie Bennett told quite a good joke about fish.
Just like a fish would have been more useful to the Green Party in the general election than me?
This fish is so old it can remember when the Green Party was an electoral force. No, it wasn't that. It was about the fact that, you know, the sort of outside, I'm not really going to not do justice to Natalie Bennett's quite good joke about fish. The outside were talking about, you know, we should, like, protecting quotes unquote our fish, and it's not like fish have passports. I'll be honest with you, Natalie Bennett's delivery added a lot to this joke.
I was going to say, I think you definitely had to be there. And I say that as someone who just spent a good 10 minutes on a Lexi Back joke.
But here was the thing, right? So, you know, Priti Patel, I thought, did a decent job. And this isn't, I know we get told off all the time for seeing the EU through the prism of the Tory leadership contest. But Priti Patel did a kind of pretty solid job, but it wasn't wildly exciting. I was actually really quite impressed by Nicky Morgan. Her speech was short, which after, you know, a whole day of listening to people talk about the EU was a mercy. It was popular, like it was, you know, it was obviously a kind of Tory inflected about security, but it wasn't, I sense that room was quite left wing and it wasn't alienating. Like, she had managed to craft a message that appealed to people in London media and activists, you know, a lot of whom will come from the Labour and left side, without kind of compromising herself. So that made me, I would buy Nicky Morgan at this point.
Yeah, I mean, I think even if she can't go all the way, she's carving out a niche in the kind of Ken Clark role of being the one who can do an interview with The Guardian or with us or with The Observer.
Yeah, she did the Indie at the weekend.
And kind of be sort of semi-reassured. The role than Cameron in his pre-Prime Minister phase, you know, the kind of, oh, I'm the nice one.
Mm.
And that is always a useful asset in the Conservative Party's armoury, in the same way that in times gone by, Labour have always done quite well by having a mean one, usually in the role of Home or Shadow Home Secretary.
Yeah, exactly. So I thought that was quite an interesting development. And then, yeah, like a lot of it, and I think this is something that we're going to keep hearing about from this sort of those two women's campaigns, is whether or not EU law has been instrumental in the equalities agenda or not. That's what they're trying to contest. So there was a big effort, and it was really interesting to see politicians from UKIP, people like, you know, Priti Patel is, I would say, you know, neo-Thatcherite. She's not.
I mean, this is someone who edited a book in which it claimed that the problem with the British economy is that Britain, quote-unquote, are among the greatest idlers in the world.
But then to see them sort of saying, well, don't worry, no one's going to come and take your maternity leave away, no one's going to come and take the maternity discrimination laws away, was quite interesting, because obviously it's that big thing about, you know, once people have got rights, it's really hard to, those like they had this whole discussion around Obamacare, didn't they? Once people have got healthcare, they kind of go, oh, this is really, this is not, yeah, this is not scary. This is kind of really, oh, now, you know, we're not dying from infected toenails anymore. This is quite good. So that was my big lesson. So a lot of fights about, you know, where the legislation comes from. Big cheers at the out launch every time anyone mentioned we're not going to be intimidated, we're not going to be bullied. Clearly, that's going to be a thing. I keep hearing from broadcasters that they're being lent on very heavily, you know, with accusations of bias. So that's, you know, repeating the Scottish nationalist playbook, really, from the last referendum.
And they're on course for a crushing defeat.
Well, no, a crushing defeat, but then one that they sort of will parlay into resentment and grievance for a long time afterwards.
Well, I think the thing is, I mean, obviously this is clearly something which exists in people's minds, and I think there is a parallel, but the thing is, it's obviously you've named lots of talented politicians from all different parties. There's no reason if you want to leave the EU to switch your vote at the next election, because if you were Labour, you've got Kate Hoey. If you were a Tory, you've got Priti Patel. If you were Green, you've got Jenny Jones, for goodness sake. You know, it's not. Whereas if you wanted to leave the United Kingdom, well,
yeah, there was one party that was offering you that. Yeah, I think that's really important. And I think the other thing that we will note is that it was quite sad. So Sarah Ludford, who I think is a good politician, she's in the Lords, spoke up in a Q&A for the Lib Dems, because obviously they don't have a woman.
Yeah.
So they're not allowed to join in any of the fun. So that's quite sad, isn't it?
I think one of the things which is slightly sad about what happened to the Lib Dems is, you know, they lost some fairly good women MPs. But also, particularly what happened to them in the European Parliament. Lib Dems love Europe. Their MEPs were really happy. You know, they really wanted to be MEPs. And to be frank, some of the MEPs who have replaced them are
clocking it in.
Yeah, and there are UKIP MEPs who obviously don't want to be there full stop. And there are Labour MEPs who, if you look at their careers, have spent decades trying to become MPs, who've gone, oh, I'll have a punt at this job. And that is a bit of a shame, because there were a lot of passionate Europeans who lost their job, and it's not like they voted to go into coalition. But such is life.
My final thought on this is that it's really interesting as well. There's a lot of grouse. There's always a lot of grousing about why are you doing specific initiative for women? Isn't it really patronising to appeal to them as women? You know, women have so many more multifaceted identities, which is all true. But there is an acknowledgement on both sides. I think it's particularly interesting on the outside, as you wouldn't think they were naturally susceptible to this argument, that the optics of the campaign are dangerously bloke-tacular, and that really risks putting off, because, you know, women over 65 are quite Eurosceptic and they're quite likely to turn out on the day. And if they feel that this is just some kind of a bunch of blokes shouting at each other, they're not going to turn out. So even the Out campaign, who don't strike me as the most, progressive right on feminist by and large, know that they can't have women. And actually, the other thing that was noted about both launches had non-white women on the panel as well. So they both accepted much better than some of the previous installments that you need to have a panel that is slightly beginning to look more like the country than George Galloway, Nigel Farage, Boris Johnson, David Cameron, George Osborne having an argument.
Yeah, and I think that's exactly right. And the danger, of course, for them is that they, as one member of one of the Leave campaigns, they get into a zone, particularly with older women, where they call the yes dear zone, where people are just like, oh, it's what my cranky husband or great granddad believes. It's crazy, but we just let him shout into the void.
I'm just going to end with a question for our listeners, which I will answer at the end of You Ask Us, which is, there is one question, according to Britain Thinks, that is the biggest predictor of how you will vote in the EU referendum. Can you guess what that question is?
I'm Caroline.
And I'm Anna.
And we host the pop culture podcast from The New Statesman, Seriously.
If you secretly care more about comics than Jeremy Corbyn, this is the podcast for you.
You can find all our episodes at newstatesman.com/SRSLY.
And now it's time to go down the line to the lobby with George.
Hi, Stephen.
Hi, George.
So Jeremy Corbyn returned to the Parliamentary Labour Party this week, having been unable to take questions the week before due to a TV appearance. And his speech, he gave a speech as well, was rather interesting because, as was briefed to journalists afterwards, he told MPs to stop the sniping, stop the name-calling, stop the backbiting, let's unify and take on the Tories. And what's interesting about that is there's actually been rather less sniping and backbiting from MPs recently, partly because the EU referendum means people have been less interested in Labour, so people have been giving fewer interviews, but also because I think some of Corbyn's critics and opponents have recognised that it's counterproductive to attack him in the media each week. So it's therefore interesting that Corbyn's now playing this card, and many MPs believe the clear strategy is to paint them as the enemy, as the troublemakers, in advance of what will likely be poor local election results.
It's a new approach to talk to the press. Is it being trailed elsewhere? Are they starting to get on the front foot about the budget next week?
There's not much sign of spin from Labour. That may change by the weekend. They did put out a poster on the Google tax deal mocking George Osborne's unfunfair, which was derided by some journalists, but actually as political posters go, wasn't too bad. What I think is still missing in some ways is a consistent message from Jeremy Corbyn. So when he won the leadership, even those who didn't want him to win were looking forward to an all-out assault on austerity, a consistently left-wing message, and they hoped it might appeal to voters in Scotland, to voters in urban areas, and perhaps to the country at large as the spending cuts continue, despite what the Tories say is the strength of the economy. But as his performance at Prime Minister's Questions showed on Wednesday, Jeremy Corbyn has very little message discipline. He finds it very hard to stick to a script, and he takes a scattergun approach. It did feel to me as if he threw the kitchen sink at David Cameron in the hope that something would stick, and it turned out that nothing did.
Then things still aren't sticking to Cameron is part of why a coup attempt is being talked about once again. There's a legal aspect to it this time, isn't there?
Yes, there is. So a disputed issue is whether Jeremy Corbyn, were he to be challenged, would get on the ballot automatically, or whether he would have to reseek nominations from MPs and MEPs. And of course, he would potentially struggle to reach the required number, because people who lent him nominations during the last selection contest will be maybe unprepared to do so again. And the Campaign for Labour Party Democracy is trying to change the rules, hoping to at the next at the NEC meeting in July, so that Corbyn would be automatically on the ballot. His team, however, are saying that were he challenged today, he would be automatically on the ballot. But there is no sign that this coup is anything other than discussion at the moment. There's still no agreements on who the candidate would be. The fear of some is that Corbyn would indeed get on the ballot one way or another, and that he would win by a similar margin to last time, and that, of course, would strengthen his leadership. I think others are hoping that even if they don't succeed this time, it will at least give them a platform to make the argument that, in their view, he's unelectable. And they think, frankly, they think Labour's position is so bad that they've got very little to lose.
Well, on that cheerful note, we'll be back next week.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
And now we're going to sit upon the ground and tell sad stories of the death of social networks. We're joined by our tech correspondent, Barbara Speed, and
me, I'm still here, I haven't left.
Always here.
Yeah. So the obvious kind of peg for this is really the fact that Twitter is 10 on March the 21st. The first tweet sent by Jack Dorsey.
I didn't know I shared a birthday with Twitter.
You do.
Oh, sorry.
It's the day that all evil came into the world. The first tweet by Jack Dorsey was just setting up my Twitter without any vowels, because he wanted to be able to use a 5-digit texting code in case you wanted to do that. And also the idea was that 140 characters was so that you could fit in your tweet and a username within an SMS, because much of it happened by SMS. This is the pain of somebody who had to go and reread Hatching Twitter in order to write a piece for the FT about Twitter. So I've got a lot of things to unload. It was nearly called Friend Stalker Smussy.
Was that because of the SMS thing, then?
Smussy.
Yeah. Oh, dear.
Yeah, I don't know how that didn't
get
off the ground.
Been dead a long time ago.
And there was something else. And they nearly called it, like, Vibrate or something like that. And that's how they got from there to Twitch to Twitter. And I didn't realise it took until November 2006 for someone to do the first at reply.
Yeah, well, another thing about Twitter is it took quite a while to become popular. That if you look at the graph of its sort of users and stuff, it takes kind of like a year to kind of reach the levels that it then enjoyed for quite a few years.
That's interesting, because I joined in June 2007. Are you saying that that's
you brought that's the when swarms it's upward swing? Yeah. Again. But like MySpace or something like that, they tended to have like a huge spike at the beginning, which they then maintained and then died like 5 years later.
Yeah, you had a nice analogy about Henry VIII's wives and social networks, which you've written up, but would you like to take our listeners through it?
Yeah, well, it relies on the slightly mean assumption that our short attention spans as social media users are quite similar to Henry VIII's lecherous approach to wives.
So is the idea that he tried to have a baby unsuccessfully for a long time with MySpace?
Yeah, I think the idea just being that similarly to Henry VIII, he had like a period of time in which he seemed to move through wives quite quickly. And I think that equally in the social media realm, we moved through quite a few big hitters quite quickly. So Friends Reunited, MySpace, but Facebook and Twitter have been around for a relatively long time without showing signs of complete collapse. I mean, they've had their ups and downs, but so in summary, my conclusion was that Twitter is Anne of Cleves, because Anne of Cleves was Henry VIII's wife for a short amount of time, but she then kind of divorced him quite quickly and managed to stick around for ages without being beheaded.
Yeah, she just hung out in some house in sort of Kent or
somewhere,
didn't
she? Yeah, just as Twitter hangs out with the media elite, doesn't really pick up any other new users.
I thought that was really interesting that they stopped releasing their data for how many tweets were sent a day. And it also revealed to me this problem that of the kind of Silicon Valley mindset about growth being absolutely everything. So the kind of classic idea if you launch something like this is that you get a load of money and you grow as fast as you can. And then once you've captured everybody on it, that's when you decide how you're going to extort the cash out of them. And the thing is that, you know, that's a reflective, again, of the advertiser funding model. You know, Twitter's users are incredibly elite. You know, if you actually charged people to use it, they could, all of those people could pay. It's just that they won't pay now. Like, now we are so inured to the idea that you shouldn't have to pay for that kind of stuff. But I think that one of the things that's interesting about the way that Twitter succeeded is it succeeded by being totally public, right? It grew up because the barrier to entry was really low. You could go and find anyone's tweets, you could read anything.
And what's interesting is that the social media networks that died basically without a trace, which are Bebo and now MySpace, which is completely gone, that they were very customizable. And what's interesting is that people have gone for Facebook and Twitter, which are much more stripped back.
But they won't even let you put your own background on and stuff like that anymore.
Because my last MySpace message, now lost to the ether, was off to university and Facebook! Exclamation mark.
Wow, did you join Facebook when it was still only available to people at university?
Yes, I think I did, yeah.
Wow.
Oh, good times.
Super elite. But that's why it's really interesting to see that actually Facebook managed to grow. It managed to give itself that kind of aura of excitedness, about, because at the beginning you had to have a university email address to sign up, and they would always kind of try and get the cool kids at a university to sign up and then do it. Which is why, you know, to talk about sad, now moribund social networks, Elo. Do you remember Elo, which was very popular for about 2 weeks? Because that was in beta and, you know, you had to kind of get an invite to get into it. People really loved that. I remember when, brace yourself, Stephen, this is how old I am. I remember when Gmail, you still had to get an invite to be allowed on Gmail. I got an invite to be on Gmail really early and I was really super excited. Although I still had to put a numeral after my name.
And so what, you got like Tyrannosaurus.rex at Gmail invited you to...
Well, no, but this is I mean, surely you must have... Actually, both of you have got relatively boring names, but this is the peril of having a really boring name, right? I have to get first and stake out my pitch on any possible social network that might go anywhere.
We both have great names. I share a name with a war criminal and Barbara has the name of a superhero.
I have the name of a really wonderful Holocaust survivor. She's in Auschwitz, and she wrote a really beautiful memoir called A Time to Speak. And because she died about 5 years ago, I'm steadily pushing her down the Google rankings.
Oh, no.
My success is directly at the expense of somebody whose works are far more profound and moving than mine. It's really tragic. But
so you basically are worse than the Nazis. They couldn't kill her, but oh god, that was, I'm going to get fired for that joke.
It's okay. What happens on the podcast stays on the podcast. It's fine. But anyway, but then maybe I can redress that balance by saying that go and read her book, because it's really beautiful. And she made a great life for herself and was a dance teacher and a choreographer. And she deserves better than to be below some sieve piece that I've written about weasels or whatever happens on the Google front page.
But so take us through the death of some of these. So, yeah, various social networks have come and gone. What happened to, I mean, Bebo? Is Bebo still out there?
No, so Bebo was funny. It launched slightly after MySpace, but was basically, for all intents and purposes, kind of the same. The successful network that came later had something new to offer, and it struggled on. It was relaunched. It was bought a couple of times, and is now relaunched as a messaging app. So if you go to Bebo.com, you're redirected to the iTunes App Store.
And MySpace had a particularly strange fake, didn't it?
Yeah, so MySpace was bought by Justin Timberlake a few years ago and was then...
I was so ready for you to say by Rupert Murdoch, and I was going to go, yes, that was
bought by Justin
Before it was bought by Time, it was bought by Justin Timberlake, who...
And the investors don't know how to act. Anyway, sorry, Barbara, back to you.
Stephen made a sexy back joke in the previous thing, and I thought, wow, is Stephen going to do two sexy back jokes in a row?
Yeah, well, they tried to bring MySpace back as a music... focused site, like a more almost like a kind of Spotify with playlists and stuff. That was very short-lived, and then the site was sold to Time Inc., who then said that they were going to use all the users' data to learn about how to do their digital advertising. So it was literally just sold to be chopped up, basically. Which is quite a sad fate for something that was massive. It was huge.
And Friends Reunited, I assume they were just killed by... Were they just killed by Facebook? Because now, obviously, we don't need to go, oh, I wonder where my friends are from high school. You're like, oh, God, pregnant again, are you?
Yeah, I think they slightly missed the boat in that they were a subscription model and they were the only thing out there, so they got pretty, like... complacent, I suppose.
Can I ask whether or not you think Tumblr counts as a social network?
So there's now a new definition, which is community websites, which is something that Tumblr, YouTube, everything else all come under. So I think it falls under that. I'm not sure if I would... It's tricky. I would call that more a blogging platform.
I'm going to end by asking you a difficult question. In 10 years' time... Which, if any, of the current social networks will make it to... You know, which are they going to make it to their 20th birthday?
Facebook. But I think it won't last much longer than that because it will be a bit of a Friends Reunited, I think. Because you've reached a billion people. It's going to take you a while to die. But I think already young people are not using Facebook in the way they used to, so I think...
What are the young people using, Barbara?
Snapchat.
The Snapchat.
All using the Snapchat.
In terms of our long-term future, does Snapchat drive traffic?
No.
Well, BuzzFeed claims that about a quarter of their users come from Snapchat.
Yeah, but you don't... Right, so Snapchat has Discover on it, and then lots of platforms are on there. BuzzFeed, Daily Mail do things.
New York Times.
But they do quite snazzy things where it opens with a GIF and you swipe through and you read a story, but it's optimised for mobile. I mean, this is the kind of thing, and we don't have time to talk about this now, but we'll come back to it, about optimising for mobile and optimising for these platforms means mostly junking all the things that cause you to load slowly, i.e. ads. i.e. the things that make you any money. So I think Snapchat Discover could offer massive reach. The reason why we're not animating GIFs, even as we speak, of Jeremy Corbyn popping out of a cake to accompany some of your fine articles, Stephen, is that, you know, it's very difficult to monetize. You know,
but
what's the point of...
people are on there in the hopes it will be monetizable. And to be fair, people said Snapchat wasn't monetizable. And now those people are paying $100,000 a day to appear on Snapchat.
You know, these are companies that are now just sitting like smog on a huge hoard of cash. Mm-hmm. And, you know, some of that's user-generated content. Some of that's because they offer a portal to the most interesting news and media content. But not... an enormous amount of it is, mm-hmm. or certainly
down, yeah.
a reasonable amount. I mean, I know that there are companies that say they're very happy with the amount of money that they make from Facebook instant articles, but it's not like a new... There's no new gold rush online for journalism. And if ad blocking comes in on mobile, we're all screwed.
So basically, kids, turn off your ad blockers. Send us money. We don't even know it's Christmas time.
But this is why you're working in a bookshop, me working for, you know, burger vans. I don't know, Barbara, what job you had as a teenager. You know, you need to...
Shoe shops.
Yeah, you need to really keep up those skills, because I don't know any of us are going to be here.
After the internet kills journalism, bookshops are going to be still around.
Burger vans will be fine.
On the streets.
But there will be no one... Oh, no, Deliveroo will have probably meant... Yeah, it's all
we
over.
We could all work for Deliveroo, to be fair.
I don't like bikes.
Right. Are you an Uber driver?
I can't drive.
Why?
Oh, I'm Ellen, you really are.
I'm unfit for the app economy, I'm afraid. Well, on that depressing note, thanks, Barbara.
This is a Manhattan-bound B Express train. The next stop is Grand Street.
Mind the gap. Hey, I'm John.
And I'm Barbara, and we present Skylines, the new podcast from City Metric, the New Statesman's urbanism site.
Every 2 weeks, you can hear us talk about cities, geography, and the human impact on the environment, and test our contention that maps make a great topic for radio.
You can find us on iTunes or Acast.
Check it out.
And and welcome to this week's You Ask Us.
What have people asked? Actually, do you know what? I've had so many. The really great thing is I've had loads and loads of responses from our last Ask Us, which was fantastic. Somebody has asked about whether or not we will be paying a little less attention to Europe, which I'm obviously very pro, but also a little more attention to some of the regional elections that are going on. We know that there are elections not only in London, but Scotland, Northern Ireland, Wales, and local elections. And yes is the answer to that. Yes, we will. We're going to do a special elections podcast. So,
hold on to your hats.
Yeah, exactly. Don't.
Although I think the question we were asked most is, why do we have such terrible taste in films? To which I reply, why do you all have such terrible taste in films?
Yeah, I was surprised.
Please don't abandon us,
listeners. By the number of people willing to defend Birdman. But yeah, very quickly, Stephen, what this week have people asked us?
The question we got, it was, is the focus on 2020 damaging Labour's duty of being a good opposition today?
I think that's a really interesting question, because I think it definitely, the perception in Westminster, whether you are, agree with it or not, that Labour will not win the next election, damages them, because it means that everything that they say is automatically downgraded. You know, everything they say is automatically less interesting. If you are the minister who is in charge of road building, saying that a road is going to be built through this particular constituency is incredibly interesting, particularly to the people who live in that constituency. If in 6 months' time you might be the minister who gets to make that decision, your words acquire salience. So the problem that Labour has at the moment is, if nobody thinks that they've got any prospect of being a government, their opinion is sort of irrelevant. You know, the Lib Dems have faced exactly this problem. I think the hardest thing as an opposition is actually just getting anyone to pay any attention to what you say at all. You really have to work really hard to get even on the pitch, really.
Yeah, I mean, I also think, I think that's exactly right. I'm going to challenge the premise of the question somewhat. So next week we've got the budget. How will Labour win the next election? Well, they need to show them the Conservatives are bad at running the economy and that they will be better at running the economy. So the day-to-day challenge of opposing the budget and winning 2020, they're not in conflict, they're linked. I mean, the point of being a good opposition is to show that the government is not as good at being the government as you would be. Yeah. But they are in that Lib Dem, William Hague zone at the moment, where much of Westminster sees them as an afterthought.
I thought it was really interesting. Listeners, feel free to correct me if I'm wrong, but I did just see scrolling past me on Twitter the idea that it's Corbyn's 100th question at PMQs, and he hasn't asked one about the economy yet. He's focused primarily on health and welfare. And I think that's a kind of, I wonder if, obviously lots of things technically come under the economy, so I wonder if that can really be true. But it's certainly for somebody who I think, this is my hunch, the primary reason that people voted Jeremy Corbyn was anti-austerity. You know, they thought that Labour had not made a good enough case against Tory cuts in the last Parliament. And that seems to be very strange that that's not his focus in...
So I am the lone defender in Westminster of Jeremy Corbyn's approach to PMQs, which probably means I'm wrong.
No, I mean, I like it. I think that bringing more people in is good.
I mean, I think then actually it makes a sense not to ask necessarily about things which are on the news agenda, because it comes back to the whole, if you're not bored, no one else has heard you. So it sort of makes sense to focus on his core issues, which is health and welfare and health and welfare. Although, despite the fact that this is not the perception of most people in the Labour Party, if you look at the postmortems of the defeat, what most swing voters thought Labour talked about was health and welfare, health and welfare.
I guess health is definitely the bigger win of those two, because just saying, I love the NHS, the Tories will kill the NHS, actually just that is a really resonant message, because it plays on themes that people already have embedded within their consciousness.
And it allows you to run an election on a fear message, which, if you can run on fear, you should always run on fear.
Yeah, well, we'll tell that to the angry people at the EU launch. But that's it, you asked us. There will be more asking of us. Someone else actually also came in to ask whether or not we could provide some commentary on speeches, like good things that people want now are asking me for homework after I ask it homework. So that's something else that we're going to look at, about, who actually has said things that are interesting and meaty and substantive. I would definitely recommend reading Michael Gove's speech when he came out. You might disagree with it, but he did lay out a very eloquent case, more eloquently than Boris in his Telegraph column a couple of days later, and that's pretty easily available online.
And Tristram Hunt is delivering a series of lectures which they're definitely interesting. They mostly seem to be incredibly off-piste and about some fairly niche subjects, but they are definitely worth reading. And then the McDonnell economic community thingy lectures are very good.
Yes, There we go. We've given you homework this time, readers. And as a bonus Easter egg in the podcast, I'm going to give you the answer to the question I asked earlier. What is the one question that predicts how you're going to vote in the EU referendum? Okay, so what I was told by Britain Thinks is the question that best predicts your voting intention is, did you go to university? And that's an interesting question because it speaks to themes we talked about before about the idea about, you know, graduates and the way that they vote, but also because it complicates that idea that the over 60s particularly are much more ardently Eurosceptic. That is a generation where only 1 in 10 people went to university as opposed to younger generations where it's much higher. So that's a good one. I think they say that if you did go to university, you are 70-30 in favour of Remain, and the other way around it is 60-40 in favour of Leave. However, they did say that the absolute best predictor of an in vote, even better than that, but obviously applies to a much smaller subset of people, is do you read The Guardian?
Oh, it's weird to think that if we stay in by a percentage point, it probably will be the responsibility of Harold Wilson and the Open University.
Well, that's a cheery thought. Yeah. You've been listening to the New Statesman podcast, presented by me, Helen Lewis, with Stephen Bush. Our producer is India Bork, and our music is Devil with a Devil by the Underscore Orchestra, licensed under Creative Commons. You can find us on iTunes or at newstatesman.com/podcast.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello, Freddie here. I want to tell you about a new way you can support the New Statesman's independent journalism. Every morning I send out Morning Call, our daily newsletter covering everything you need to know about British politics. It's free to sign up, plus for just £3 a month, you'll get a recommended daily piece of ours sent to you in full, plus exclusive polling analysis from Ben Walker, a weekly update from Will Dunn, and our featured piece on Sundays. If you enjoy this podcast, you'll love Morning Call. Head to morningcall.substack.com and subscribe now.